You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg has joined former Vice President Joe Biden, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders at the top of the leaderboard in the third Monmouth University poll of the 2020 Iowa Democratic caucuses. Buttigieg's gains since the summer have been across the board, with increasing support coming from nearly every demographic group. Regardless, less than one-third of likely caucus-goers say they're firmly set on their choice of candidate, and most would not be too disappointed if they had to switch their support. And Democratic presidential candidates, Colorado U.S. Senator Michael Bennet, Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, and Minnesota U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar campaigned in Northwest Iowa last weekend. On Saturday morning, Klobuchar joined a caucus training session at the Sioux City Public Library. At that event, Klobuchar said she wanted to help Iowa farmers and ethanol producers who have struggled because of the ongoing trade war with China and ethanol waivers to oil refineries. Klobuchar said those two factors have led more farmers to file for bankruptcy. She says President Trump is directly at fault.
The way he is putting these farmers under, we've seen a 25% increase in farm bankruptcies. And in fact, I led the bill on the Democratic side with Senator Grassley, and who led it on the Republican side, that we passed and got signed into law. That made it easier for farmers who go into bankruptcy. We just did that this year because of what we're seeing, so that they could keep operating their farms. Needless to say, the president didn't do a signing ceremony about it, but I think it is an example of the fact that there's some real problems out here, and the president, by how he's handled the trade negotiations with China, how he's given secret oil waivers to the oil companies from the renewable biofuel standard, that he's made things worse. And that's what I mean when I say he's treating them like poker chips.
Klobuchar says if elected, she would like to focus on three main issues in her first year.
The top issues will be less expensive health care, including less expensive pharmaceutical prices, immigration reform, something I think is really, really important in this area, that we have a path to citizenship, and it'll actually be good for the economy in Iowa because you don't have enough workers in your factories, in your fields, and some of your hospitals and nursing homes, and climate change.
Klobuchar says one unique thing she has done is to set up a 100-day plan to use if she becomes president.
Which is a change of tone in our politics, and I think the people have broken down trust with government, and this will mean we can get a bunch of stuff done in the first 100 days. Instead of just focusing only on these long-term bills, I have over 100 things that you can get done in 100 days.
Klobuchar was also asked about the impeachment proceedings this week and whether Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden should be questioned about their dealings in the Ukraine.
I have not been involved in that, so I just think that the proceedings are starting, and I think that there's been a lot of evidence that they didn't do anything wrong here. But I think what's most important is that for the issue at hand, we are going to see firsthand, we're going to be able to see these diplomats and ambassadors testify about what really happened here. And these include Republican appointees, they include career people who are not political, they include one guy who graduated from West Point and has been in the diplomatic corps for 50 years.
Klobuchar compared the Senate's job in the impeachment process to one half of a ubiquitous legal procedural program.
I just know that our focus is going to be on the trial in the Senate and making sure that that's fair and working with the Chief Justice. That is a whole different thing. I always point out it's like the Law and Order show, except it's not a criminal proceeding. The first half, they gather the evidence. They talk to all the witnesses. The second half is the trial. We will be the second half.
That was Minnesota U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar, who is a Democratic presidential candidate. She spoke at a caucus training session held by the Woodbury County Democrats at the Sioux City Public Library on Saturday morning. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Colorado U.S. Senator Michael Bennett was in Sioux City on Friday. He met with potential caucus-goers at Hardline Coffee downtown. I spoke with Bennett on the phone before he arrived on Friday. Bennett has been perceived as a moderate on issues like health care and immigration, and I asked him what people are saying to him about those issues on the campaign trail.
I would say overwhelmingly the concern I hear from people is that they're working really hard, but they can't afford some combination of housing, health care, higher education, and early childhood education. In other words, they can't afford a middle-class life. And when I think about the families I used to work for when I was superintendent of the Denver Public Schools, which is about a 95,000-kid school district in Colorado, most of the kids were kids of color. Most of the kids lived in poverty, and their parents, you know, who are not coming to town halls, but if they did, because they're working two or three jobs, what they'd say is, we're killing ourselves, but no matter what we do, we can't get our kids out of poverty. And those are two sides of the same coin. And those anecdotes reflect an economy that for 50 years has worked only for the people at the very top of our economic food chain and really for nobody else. And I don't believe we can sustain another 10 years like that, which is why, for example, I don't want to spend the next 10 years fighting a losing battle on Medicare for All, which some of the other candidates in this race have been running on. I think that would distract us from the ability to provide a tax code that actually gave the middle class a real tax cut and some money to spend on their kids. Created a situation where we could dramatically reduce childhood poverty, as I proposed in my plan. It would distract us from the work that we need to do to make our schools better and to address climate change. All of that will be lost if we spend our time focused on an ideological battle over health care that's not really going to ever move forward.
You definitely have a different take on this, because especially when it comes to immigration, because you're not necessarily against some kind of barrier, but you feel it should be part of an overall strategy, and you think the DACA folks should be allowed to become citizens.
Exactly. I mean, I am the only person in this race who wrote an immigration bill, and I wrote it with John McCain and six other senators. We were called the Gang of Eight at the time in 2013. And that bill, which I think reflected where the public is on immigration, created a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million people that are undocumented. It had the most progressive Dream Act that had ever been considered on the floor of the Senate, much less voted on in a bipartisan way. And it had $46 billion of border security, not the $6 billion that Donald Trump wants for, you know, centuries old technology, but 21st century technology that would allow us to see every inch of the border and know who was coming across and who we needed to stop. It allowed us to deal with the problem that 40% of the people that have come here that are undocumented came lawfully on visas, but overstayed their visas, and we have no way of dealing with that today.
I just wanted to ask you briefly about some of the ag policies, and you come from a state where ag is important as well, talking about the tariff situation with China especially. What is your take on that?
Well, I've been on the Ag Committee longer than I've been on any other committee. I've been there from the day I walked into the Senate until now, which has been 10 years, and I've helped write two farm bills. I believe the president was right to call the question on China, but did it in a terribly clumsy way and put our farmers and ranchers in my state and the farmers in Iowa right in the crosshairs of the of people around the world who saw them as the opportunity to take retribution against the United States. And our farmers have enough trouble as it is. I mean, commodity prices, as you know, are low. The cost of inputs are very high. The weather has been terrible, and that creates uncertainty. And then on top of that, the tariffs are basically just a tax on our producers. So we should never have been in this situation to begin with. My hope is that we will somehow get out of this trade war with China and restore our ability to export around the world. When you know, you see how hard people work to open up the Chinese market for soybeans, or to open up the Chinese market in the case of my state for dairy. And then all of that has now been locked down, and Brazil is cutting down the rainforest to grow soybeans when we've got soybeans just, you know, being warehoused. It just doesn't make any sense. And I don't think the president really has a strategy.
I wanted to ask you, you know, your take on the standards for taking part in this next debate, December 8th, because they seem pretty high. You have to have something like 200,000 unique donations. You've got to have, you know, X amount of percent in the early nominating states, each number. And I was one of those. Do you think that it's too strict?
I do. I mean, it sounds self-interested to me to say it, so I'll confess that. But I do think it's too strict, and I think it measures the wrong things. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, the only candidate in this race who's actually won two swing states in this country. The Colorado is a purple state, not easy to win races like that. And I would think that having had that kind of success in the past would be a useful criteria to apply to the debate stage, rather than how successfully people launder money through Facebook to raise these donations that they're having to spend money to raise. You know, it's kind of a crazy way of doing it. And I think that it risks sort of prematurely nationalizing the race when Iowa has not yet reached its decision and New Hampshire's not reached their decision. And so I'm just going to keep plugging away. You know, I had a decision to make, which was to spend money trying to stay in the debate stage or to spend it communicating with people in Iowa. And I decided to spend it communicating with people in Iowa. So time will tell whether that was smart or not. But I've certainly loved my time in the state.
That was Colorado U.S. Senator Michael Bennett, who's also a Democratic presidential candidate. He campaigned in Northwest Iowa last weekend. Well, Bennett talked quite a bit about agriculture tariffs and what's going on with the ag economy. Last week, a special convocation took place on the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College that took a closer look at global issues concerning agriculture. One of the panelists was Gary Wright, a farm management specialist with Iowa State University Extension and Outreach. Wright serves 13 counties in Northwest Iowa, including Woodbury. He shared details on the current state of agriculture in Siouxland with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer.
We've had 3 or 4 years in a row of very strong yields in general. Okay, and I say that, and then with people listening that have had a hailstorm or lost because of a drought or something like that, there's been some little micro areas. But beyond that, Northwest Iowa has been had very strong above trend line yields for the last 3 to 4 years. Right now, this year, to answer your question directly, we are probably looking at less yields than trend line because we've had 2019 has been a year of everything with too much heat, too much cold, too much water, not enough water, the whole combinations that farming deals with every year. This year has been interesting from that standpoint. So we're going to expect the yields to be off. Both corn and soybean yields will be off from trend lines. That's the best expectation that as we're heading into it. We won't know until January. That's when the USDA comes out with their final 2019 crop report. Based on information we have right now, that was based on both the USDA as well as some private industry trade estimates, it looks like now we'll be off both corn and soybeans compared to the last 2 or 3 years. But again, we got to compare ourselves not to those record-breaking years, but it's still expected to be at or below average, but and certainly it's going to be a lot more than what it has been the last 3 or 4 years because of the excellent crops we've had.
What kind of impact are the tariffs from China making on the farmers that you see here in Northwest Iowa?
Well, the amount of soybeans especially that went to China is very substantial. 1 out of 2 soybeans in general gets exported, but the bigger share of the total is what has gone to China in the past. There's a lot of soybeans that are grown in Northwest Iowa, so that's obviously very much a direct impact. The most recent information, though, based on what we've heard and seen, it does appear that China is back in the market. They've got 1.4 billion people to feed, and soybeans and or they're feeding soybeans to either people or their livestock. They've had to buy that. It becomes a problem if they don't buy it. They got to get it from someplace. And the U.S. is very efficient at growing of soybeans. We've got to, even as much as the crop is off for this year compared to the past years, we're available, and we do have an advantage to South America when it comes to putting soybeans on a boat going to China. It's a lot cheaper from the U.S. than it is from South America. So it's a factor, but we are seeing right now, at least, and again, we've heard of some glimpses of we're getting closer to maybe signing a trade deal. That really, some of those numbers have already kind of shown up, it appears.
Do you think any producers could be put out of business because of what's been happening with China?
Well, I don't know that it would be specific to China. I think you got to step back and I think in terms of just overall margins as you go back, you know, again, since 2012, we've really been on a downhill run in terms of net farm income, even though this last year actually we had a little bit of a blip upswing in that regard even. We're going to have, I think the estimates I've heard from several people are suggesting anywhere from 10 to 25% difference in who might be farming that land this next year compared to this year. Now, that is not necessarily all bankruptcies. That could be people deciding to no longer farm because margins are not good. It might be a person that was, you know, the average age of our farmers in Iowa. I think this last, some last term, we had a 2017 survey, I think, was telling us close to 58, 59 years old. It's an aging population. So maybe they're just getting to the point where they're saying margins are tight. I'm not going to do it anymore. That could be a factor. It could be some instances where a farmer who has done very well is maybe a son or daughter's coming home and they're wanting to increase their operation size. So there might be some land, additional land that they're going to be perhaps farming. But the overall theme seems to be 10 to 25% of the land might be ending up being farmed by somebody else. There are a lot of those factors. Well, certainly have one, unfortunately, will be bankruptcies. We believe that based on this information that we've heard.
One thing kind of still fueling the farm economy, strong land prices.
Yes, and that's a key factor right now. Again, if you go back to the 1980s, and I get often asked, are we in a repeat of the 1980s? And my response regularly is no. But the biggest distinction is today, as we've seen, I believe it's four of the last five years, land prices, farmland prices have gone down, but very modestly gone down, single-digit reductions. The repeat of the 1980s was when land prices were we're seeing some double-digit reductions. And when it happens that fast, the financial challenges that creates are even greater. And so as a result of that, if we can hold on to farm prices, that means our solvency will continue to be maintained as adequate. We're not going to have perhaps banks having to totally restructure a bunch of loans. We've kind of went through a time frame because land prices have held together. There has been some liquidity losses that farmers have been able to go ahead and borrow some long-term money. And again, that basically means that they're able to replenish some lost liquidity, be able to operate with their farming operation. They had land prices that held together to allow them to do that. We might be now at a point where maybe, you know, we've used up all that solvency right now. It appears, anyway, based on the numbers we're looking at right now.
That's Gary Wright, a farm management specialist with ISU Extension. Wright has spent the past 35 years working on agricultural issues. He says it's important that the U.S. Congress passes the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. Wright also says Japan is another key trade market for Iowa agricultural products. Japan accounted for almost $13 billion in U.S. exports, making one of the top five countries for exports. It was number four last year.
California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
There was a warm welcome in Siouxland this week for Chris Godfrey, who grew up in Sioux City and eventually achieved a law degree from Drake University in Des Moines. Godfrey made headlines in Iowa during the past few years when he sued former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad for discrimination and won. A special reception took place Monday night in Sioux City, and Siouxland Public Media Sheila Brummer was there and explains how Godfrey received a special accolade from his hometown.
Veterans Day actually probably is a great day to hold this event, because without the people that fought for our freedoms, for us to have equality, to have a justice system, we wouldn't be what we are as a country.
Chris Godfrey, a native of Sioux City and an East High graduate, won a high-profile discrimination lawsuit against former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad. Godfrey attended an event at St. Mark Lutheran Church in support of the LGBTQ group One Iowa. He briefly talked about the legal battle he faced. But before his speech, Sioux City Councilmember Rhonda Capron made a surprise announcement.
On behalf of the mayor, city council, and citizens of Sioux City, do hereby commend Chris Godfrey for leading by example and being a trailblazer for human and workers' rights.
This summer, a jury found Branstad discriminated against Godfrey because of his sexual orientation and awarded the former state workers' compensation commissioner $1.5 million. Godfrey currently works for the U.S. Department of Labor in Washington, D.C. as a chief judge working on federal workers' compensation disputes.
I wouldn't be who I was today if I didn't have the family that's here supporting me and the friends that are here supporting me, the community in and of itself supporting me. So thank you all very much.
The Des Moines Register reported the taxpayers of Iowa spent almost $2.5 million on legal fees for the defense. Godfrey's attorney also asked a judge to cover $3.5 million in fees and costs. The state of Iowa's asked the court for a new trial in the case. For Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
A few dozen people, including family and friends, attended the event where Chris Godfrey also talked about the latest in the legal battle in the case. Godfrey also referenced one of his attorneys on his legal team, Paige Fiedler, who also attended the special gathering.
So we've had our day in court and we won, and we won on all of the counts. But now we're in the position where $3 million worth of legal fees already down. We're dealing with situations where there is a 180-page brief that's been filed asking for a new trial and claiming all sorts of unfairness that they had to deal with and how they were prejudiced. But the things that are in that brief that bother me the most, the first one says that I have slaughtered more Christians than Nero. Yeah, your tax dollars are paying for this. Just let me tell you that. Obviously, by asking one jury question about whether someone could adequately judge the evidence in the case, in a sexual orientation case, that equates me and my counsel to have slaughtered Christians. Well, as a Christian, I take offense at that. They don't own the religion. We all do. Again, that's one thing that's bothered me. The other thing that's bothered me is some of the language that's used is language you would think that trial attorneys would know better when you're defending someone in a sexual orientation discrimination case. You shouldn't talk about the plaintiff's lifestyle. My lifestyle is going home most nights, going for a run, cuddling with cats and going to bed so I can get up to work the next day. That's my lifestyle. Who I am is not my lifestyle. And for the defendants to continue to degrade the things that we're talking about, saying it's nothing more than a lifestyle, I think in and of itself is somewhat of an admission on their part that they just don't get it. And the last thing that has really bothered me was during the trial itself, Paige talked a little bit about some of the theatrics that we dealt with. The one that I like that she didn't tell you about was the day that I was on the stand, actually one of the days I was on the stand, the defense attorney wore this really kind of weird tie. And I think it was Paige that went up to him and said, you know, what is that tie? Is it something special or does it have some special meaning? And he said, yes, it was blessed by a member of his church to protect him from sin on the day he was cross-examining me. So that is who is representing all of you as Iowans. So I hope that as time goes on, the court will deal with these arguments for what they are. You know, it's obviously their right to appeal. I would never stand in their way of doing that. But I would hope they would have some civility to treat me, to treat my counsel, to treat the community in a fair and honest way. So hopefully that is what happens.
Siouxland Public Media reached out to defense attorney Frank Hardy of the law firm Nye Master Good from Des Moines on statements made by Godfrey, Hardy released this statement: "My professional ethics prevent me from commenting on a pending case, but I urge you to read the defendant's briefing to understand what occurred at trial. As for the statement by Ms. Fielder and Mr. Godfrey that I wore a, quote, special tie blessed by a member of my church to protect me from sin while cross-examining the plaintiff, I can only say that the statement is an intentional misrepresentation or the sort of factual sloppiness that is a byproduct of a mindset that sees religion as akin to a hobby." Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Monday was Veterans Day, and vets, city, and county officials met Monday morning at the Woodbury County Courthouse to pay tribute. Mary Jordan spoke. She's the director of the Sioux City Vet Center. Jordan told the group of around 125 people that her organization serves combat veterans and helps them to readjust to civilian life.
Maybe it's a mental health condition, specifically trauma-related, we work with, and those that have experienced military sexual trauma as well. We work with them in individual and group settings. We work with them to help find jobs.
The 2017 census numbers show there are more than 5,800 veterans in Woodbury County. Well, several events throughout Siouxland honored Veterans Day. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer takes us to one at Western Iowa Tech Community College.
In recognition of Veterans Day, today we are hosting this event.
The president of Western Iowa Tech greets students and the community for a short ceremony to honor members of the military.
We also welcome all veterans in attendance today.
A presentation of the colors by the 185th Air Refueling Wing. And the singing of the national anthem.
Oh, say can you see?
Plus a tribute to the POW MIA by Army Sergeant First Class and Western Iowa Tech Community College instructor Bill Kuntz.
You may notice this small table here in a place of honor. It is set for one. This table is our way of symbolizing that members of our profession of arms are missing from our midst.
It was a humbling experience today. It's the first time I've given that speech. Every time I hear it, I tear up and try to focus on the words, and it is powerful, especially when you're standing right there in front of the table.
The chair is empty. They are not here. Remember.
Rhonda Briggs, a psychology instructor at the college, is the faculty advisor for the Military Club, who organized the Veterans Day celebration.
Well, we have a lot of military learners. We have a lot of veterans who are teachers and staff on campus, and we never really recognized Veterans Day. So in our military club, somebody came up with the idea we should have a Veterans Day event, and it just kind of sprung out of that.
Briggs came to Western Iowa Tech after retiring from the 185th 15 years ago. This day also brings emotion.
What does this day mean to you?
The people that didn't come home. For me, that's the main thing, is the people that gave all, that never came home. I think it's important to recognize them.
Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?
Bill Kuntz also shared his thoughts on serving in the military for more than 20 years.
And what does it mean to you to be able to serve your country?
You know, I get asked this question a lot, quite often, and to be brutally honest with you, it's a blessing to me. I'm honored and blessed to have the opportunity to serve. It was right after high school. I was not prepared for college at all, was not prepared for life in general at all after high school. And the Army gave me the opportunity to grow up very fast, gave me the opportunity to travel, meet unbelievable people, comrades that I'll have with me for the rest of my life. And it's just truly been a blessing. It was not necessarily a calling early on. It was my father and grandfather before me both served. And at the time I thought, well, this is something that I'm able to do, so I might as well give it a shot. And it has stuck with me. It's a part of my life now. So.
And over your years of service, have you been in some situations? You said you traveled quite a bit. Any situations as far as like wartime? I don't know if you were ever stationed in the Middle East at all.
You know, my first deployment, I was 19 years old. It was during Desert Storm. We left, it's a funny story, we left Christmas Eve of 1990, got on a plane in Frankfurt, Germany, and landed Christmas Day of 1990. Into Saudi Arabia. I was 19 years old. I was dumb. I was cocky. I was, you know, I'm going to take on the world. And it was a very eye-opening experience. And saw a lot of things at 19 that maybe I wish I wouldn't have saw. My next deployment wasn't until, it was just not too long ago. It was almost 25 years later was my next deployment. It was much easier. It was a sustainment deployment, so it wasn't a combat-driven type thing. During Desert Storm, we were blessed. The ground battle lasted 100 hours, so at best, we saw 25, 30 hours of action of enemy fire. So there were moments that it was rough, but I just look back at those as opportunities, and the doors that being a veteran has opened for me are unbelievable. They're just absolutely incredible, and it's more of a blessing for me to have the opportunity to be a veteran than it is truly for me to serve. It's an honor. It's what I do. So.
And this is Veterans Day. What are your thoughts and insight on this day that is meant to honor people who have served their country and even some paid the ultimate sacrifice?
And I think that more than anything else is where I'm humbled the most is of all the veterans that aren't here because of the ultimate sacrifice that they made. It's at that point that we remember them. You know, it's one thing to be honored to have a day that everybody comes and shakes your hand and thanks you for your service. But it's humbling to remember the brothers that came before you, and the brothers and sisters that lost their life in battle and lost their life in certain places. And it's that memory that I always hope our country as a whole keeps very much in mind. It's overwhelming the support that we get from the American people in our community and even outside of the community. Everywhere that we go, we have that unbelievable support, and it is extremely humbling. I just, as long as we can keep remembering of those that came before us, I think that's the most important part.
Can you tell me a little bit about the importance of what you did today?
Absolutely. The POW MIA table is set at all of these different presentations, and in every dining facility worldwide for Americans, there is a POW MIA table, and the table is set for that specific reason, that we will not forget our brothers in arms that were taken prisoner of war or are still missing in action.
You may notice this small table here in a place of honor. It is set for one. This table is our way of symbolizing that members of our profession of arms are missing from our midst. They are commonly called POWs or MIAs. We call them brothers. They are unable to be with us today, and so we remember them. The table is one, and it is small. It symbolizes the fertility of one prisoner against oppressors. The tablecloth is white. It symbolizes the purity of their intentions to respond to their country's call of arms. The single rose displayed in a vase reminds us of the families and the loved ones of the comrades in arms who keep faith awaiting their return. The red ribbon tied so prominently on the vase is reminiscent of the red ribbon worn on the lapel and breast of thousands who bear witness to their unyielding determination, to demand a proper accounting of our missing. A slice of lemon is on a bread plate to remind us of their bitter fate. There is salt upon the bread plate, symbolic of the family's tears as they wait. The glass is inverted. They cannot toast with us today. The chair is empty. They are not here. Remember, all of you who served with them and called them comrades, who depended on their might and aid and relied on them, for surely they have not forsaken you.
That's Sergeant First Class Bill Kuntz. He's currently with the U.S. Army Reserve's 9th Battalion of the 95th Quartermaster Regiment out of Des Moines. He's also a faculty member in the Industrial Robotics and Automation Program at Western Iowa Tech Community College. To see photos from the Veterans Day event at Western Iowa Tech, check out kwit.org. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Veterans of all the United States wars are honored on Veterans Day. The veterans of World War II that landed on Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944, are often hailed as part of the team that signaled the end of the war when the Allies landed in Normandy for the D-Day invasion. Many Iowans and Nebraskans served in that war. Some of them were journalists. One of them that may have been forgotten in recent years was Barney Oldfield. And we're not talking about the once famous early race car driver. This Barney Oldfield was a University of Nebraska-Lincoln journalism graduate. He coordinated a group of journalist paratroopers who dropped into Normandy behind the lines 6 days before the D-Day invasion. UNL professor of journalism and documentarian Barney McCoy last spring produced a segment on Oldfield for Nebraska Educational Television, and he's also working on a documentary about Oldfield and the other journalists who served in the war with him and dropped into Normandy. I asked McCoy about Oldfield and how the journalists that dropped behind the lines got messages to the outside world.
He had always been fixated on becoming an entertainment reporter and wanting to go to Hollywood, and actually was kind of like the Nebraska bureau reporter for one of the Hollywood newspapers for quite some time, and he would do movie reviews and that kind of thing. But he was really very gifted as a journalist. And when World War II came along, he enlisted. He became one of the first to be trained as an airborne Army soldier. And when World War II came along, was a public information officer who helped to work with the correspondents who all wanted to be involved in the reporting of the D-Day invasion.
I just think it's interesting, you know, going from interviewing Clark Gable and Shirley Temple and doing this sort of Entertainment Tonight radio show out in Hollywood to then going to work with Dwight Eisenhower.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think he was attracted to not just celebrities, but to people who were very influential. He had a great deal of reverence towards Dwight D. Eisenhower and towards the generals that he reported to in the airborne. And ultimately had been able to convince months before the Normandy invasion on June the 6th of 1944, what if we could somehow recruit some war correspondents that would be willing to go through airborne jump school, go through the training, complete successful jumps so that they would actually be able to fly with the airborne hours before the kickoff of that invasion and parachute behind enemy lines and be there and report as the airborne soldiers attacked from behind.
You know, when I watched some of the report that was on NET about Barney Oldfield, and he said something to the effect of, if you didn't know what fear was, you would find out when you were standing there, you know, waiting to be, you know, shoved out of this plane over Normandy. You knew.
Absolutely. And to put that into some perspective for you, those planes were flying in at very low altitudes, and it was pitch dark. And they would look out that open door, and the only light they would see was the light of the moon on that night and the arc of the German tracer fire firing from the ground, trying to pick off as many of those paratroopers in the air before they hit the ground as they could. And that's what they were jumping into. So if you talk about a literal leap of faith, it was.
I couldn't help but think, just from a reporter's point of view, maybe today young reporters don't know how heavy a typewriter is. He had a typewriter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had a typewriter. In fact, it's sitting behind me here in my office. And it's the same typewriter that Barney had since the early 1930s when he first began writing as a cub reporter for the Lincoln Journal here in town. And it went with him around the world. Everywhere he went, it was one of those, you know, extremely portable typewriters. But as a paratrooper, before they even began recruiting correspondents, he wanted to jump with that typewriter to see if it would withstand the force of, you know, jumping out of a plane and landing on the ground. And that was the prototype that they used to prove that, yes, in fact, a correspondent could jump with their typewriter and make it and be able to, you know, report and get dispatches out once they hit the ground in France and beyond, all the way into Berlin.
I hadn't realized that they were doing, when I first read this, they were going before. They had to go through enemy territory. Is that right? That sounds extremely dangerous.
Oh, yeah. No, they were parachuting into enemy territory. And there was active battle, combat going on from the moment they hit the ground. The Germans knew that the Allies were coming. They didn't know exactly when. They didn't know exactly where. But they had prepared all kinds of defensive positions on the ground. Part of the airborne invasion also included gliders that the Germans had put up, these huge stakes along the ground in Normandy, so the gliders would hit these stakes and be destroyed. They had flooded fields to keep the gliders from being able to land, or if paratroopers landed, they might drown. So they had really done a good job of trying to dig themselves in. They knew that there was going to be this onslaught. There was no secret that this invasion was pending.
So they landed.
Yeah. They did.
And they got through. And
yes,
they started sending reports. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. All six correspondents were able to make it back alive. One of the correspondents broke his leg. But that was the worst of the wear and tear that happened. He broke his leg when he parachuted and hit the ground awkwardly. But yeah, but they, from the get-go, they, Bob Rubin was the first of those correspondents to be able to hit the ground. There were roughly 13,000 airborne paratroopers that jumped in the early morning hours of June the 6th. And Bob Rubin was in the very first plane of the hundreds and hundreds of planes that ferried those paratroopers over into the battlefield. He was number six to jump of the 13,000 that jumped. General Maxwell Taylor was number two.
It seems incredible that at that time, the amount of danger that not just Americans, but English, French, all of the allies were willing to go through and risk their lives because of the threat to their to all of our way of lives here.
It was really interesting because Dwight D. Eisenhower knew that this was going to be an incredibly risky and costly operation. And he visited with many of the airborne soldiers before they actually took off from that airfield. And very frankly, had instructed the men that, you know, many of you will not come back from this operation, and thank them for being willing to really make that ultimate sacrifice. You know, we talk about that term ultimate sacrifice, but when you really watch it play out in the letters and the descriptions that you hear from people like Barney Oldfield, but more specifically from the correspondents that landed in Normandy and were reporting on what they saw, it's a very, very powerful, powerful part of sacrifice.
There's a great story that I saw in material about this particular mission that Bob Rubin, who you mentioned before, who was an Omaha newsman, he sent a message via carrier pigeon. Is that right?
You know, he had parachuted in. He decided, I can either land in an open field where the Germans will see me and perhaps shoot and kill me, or I can go for the orchard. I'm going to go for the orchard. So he lands in this orchard, and he's now hanging about 5 feet off the ground. His parachute is stuck in the tree, so he pulls out a big knife, and he cuts himself down. And in darkness, all of the soldiers were given these little clickers. They called them crickets. And that's how they would identify themselves to each other. They would, you know, those little clickers, you click them on, and they kind of make a cricket sound. And so that's how they would identify themselves to each other, that they were friendly and not enemies. So, you know, they're going through this darkness with these little clickers. And somehow he winds up jumping into a trench with General Maxwell Taylor. And, you know, and now they're trying to get to this village where they need to take out and secure a bridge. And they're going through all these things. And let me see, I've got it right here. So now Rubin is saying, as we dog trotted along one stretch, I noticed a soldier with a couple of cartons tied around his neck. They contained carrier pigeons. I talked him out of a pigeon, scribbled my first story, fastened it to the bird. We shooed him into the air. The story got through, the first story written from liberated France, and it was published throughout the world under the slug by carrier pigeon.
This is almost Game of Thrones stuff, you know, with the ravens.
Yeah. It's just amazing. And of course, that carrier pigeon had to fly 150 miles back across the English Channel through enemy fire itself to be able to get to that pigeon coop where that message was given to Barney Oldfield, who could then share that with the world. So,
what did Barney do after the war?
After the war, for a while, he was back in Hollywood as a press agent for Warner Brothers. And then he was recruited to go actually and work for the Air Force as part of the, I think he was out in Colorado with a wing of the Strategic Air Command, and spent the rest of his career until he retired, I think in the early 1960s, as actually a member of the Air Force, although during World War II, he was an airborne and he was an Army officer. So, but you know, then ultimately after that, he was in private industry for a while, but Barney really believed in the importance that journalists played in being the independent ears and eyes, observers, to be able to tell the world what was happening. Particularly on the battlefield in remote locations around the world. And that was something that Eisenhower also strongly believed in, that, you know, that the having a reporter write in a newspaper article or make a broadcast and personally report on the efforts of the men and the women who were, you know, leading the Allied fight, it was huge for morale, not just on the battlefield where some of these soldiers would read their names or hear about their units, and knowing that the people back home were being informed about what they were doing, the sacrifices they were making, but also the, you know, the husbands, the wives, the fathers, the mothers, the brothers, the sisters, everyone back in this country who were desperate to know, you know, what their sons and daughters were doing as they fought in the war, too.
Often we hear stories about people that were heroes, but we can't connect with them so easily. I mean, here's a guy from a little town in Nebraska who went to the University of Nebraska. He feels like someone, anyone that we might have known or our grandparents would have known.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, again, Barney, people described him and all, and they go, oh, you know, we could never tell. He was like the P.T. Barnum sometimes. You know, he was a great storyteller, and sometimes we had to try and figure out where the fact began and the myth ended. But he was really determined to make sure that journalists were represented. You know, he was a co-founder of the Radio and Television News Directors Association back in the early 1960s. But, you know, something else that I think that was really important to make notice of is that Barney never forgot his origins here in Nebraska. And he and his wife, Veda, raised millions of dollars that have helped to fund scholarships for students to this day here in this college and across the university for people that otherwise wouldn't be able to attend college. And I also thought it was really classy. A lot of those scholarships were named on behalf of some of the first American soldiers from Nebraska that died in the Normandy invasion.
I know you're working on a documentary, is that right?
Yes, my next objective is to take this story and to expand it and build on it and more completely talk about the role that these correspondents played as they not only landed in Normandy, but certainly in the case of Bob Rubin, went all the way to Berlin in the pivotal battle, the Battle of Berlin, which ended the war effectively in Europe.
That was University of Nebraska Lincoln Professor of Journalism and documentarian Barney McCoy. As he says, he's working on a documentary about the journalists who worked behind the lines in World War II. And that's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.